Support for the New Hampshire News Recap comes from you, our listeners, and from New Hampshire Community Loan Fund, helping neighbors invest in neighbors to realize their dreams of affordable homeownership and small business growth. More details at communityloanfund.org/radio.
It's Morning Edition here on NHPR. Time for the New Hampshire News Recap. We're recapping some of the week's news. New Hampshire lawmakers wrapped up their official work this week. They voted on a slate of bills that had resulted from the end of the session negotiations. NHPR's senior political reporter Josh Rogers logged a lot of time at the State House this week, and he joins us now in studio. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning, Mark.
Okay, so Josh, anyway, thanks for being here so early. I know after a long week and a long evening.
I can handle it. It's nice to be with you, Rick.
That's good to be with you, too. Josh, what were some of the remaining loose ends in terms of legislation yesterday?
Well, I guess if the bills survived yesterday, I'd say the proposal that will require voters across the state to consider capping local property taxes tied to schools, that's a big one. Another, I'd say, is a bill that would lift the filing threshold on the state's business enterprise tax and create a triggering mechanism to drop the BET's rate should revenue and savings targets be met. That's another big one politically, I'd say.
Okay, two big potential changes there, very close to taking effect. Let's talk about how those would work. Why don't we start with the tax cap?
Sure. What the tax cap bill will do, will put a question on the ballot in November and again in 2028 in every city and town in the state, asking voters if they'd support limiting increases in local property taxes tied to education and set that limit to inflation and to growth in local property value. So beyond those factors, local taxes tied to education could not rise. And that would require three-fifths support in school districts for that to take place. And, you know, once that cap were in place, it could also be overridden by a three-fifths vote. The cap's backers, Republicans, top Republicans in the House really pushed this. They say that putting this before voters in a state election rather than during town and city elections will ensure that the will of more voters and not the smaller subset that participates in municipal elections are heard on this issue. And the bill's critics, which include pretty much every Democrat, some municipal groups and teachers unions, they say this bill's bound to make it harder for school districts to operate and won't erase the real costs that school districts face from things like special education to fulfilling teacher contracts to rising health insurance costs or from any new mandates that could be imposed by the state. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out in the districts that may adopt it functionally, to be sure, but also in terms of the politics of it and how those get expressed during campaign seasons, both, you know, this November and 2 years from now.
Yeah, we're likely to see a tapestry across the state with it. I mean, this is a three-fifth of voters in a school district agree to this.
Yes, three-fifths.
Okay. Republicans, at least some of them, seem to think that this could be a potent way to drive up voter turnout come November. Do you agree?
Well, we'll see. There are Republicans who believe, you know, forcing a vote on a local tax cap will get more conservative voters, maybe even new conservative voters, to turn out. That's something they want to do, particularly given you know, sagging popularity of Donald Trump, who's not going to be on the ballot, but will loom over all these races. You know, midterm elections favor the party out of power typically, and so that would be Democrats and Republicans. I've talked to really do see this as a tool, as a way to sell tax relief, and you know, I think the same goes for the changes the legislature passed yesterday regarding the BET, the business enterprise tax, and you know. We can talk about that if you want.
Yeah, let's talk more about that, Josh. What would that bill do?
Well, you know, the bill was a priority item for top House Republicans. It aimed to shave a half a percentage point from the business enterprise tax. You know, it's one of the largest sources of state revenue, that tax. And, you know, citing concerns over the potential of lost revenue, the state Senate tried to scrap the idea of an outright rate cut and instead pushed to lift the filing threshold, excuse me, on that tax right now. The filing threshold sits at $297,000. Under this bill, it would climb to $400,000. So fewer businesses would end up having to pay the tax altogether. The final version of this bill also would send some money to nursing homes to boost Medicaid provider rates. That was another Senate priority. But the final version of the bill also includes a trigger to automatically ratchet down the BET's rate if collections from the tax come in $100 million over target, and the state also carries a maximum balance in its rainy day fund. So the likelihood that those you know, that those things appear on the state's balance sheet at the same time, you know, could be remote. But the bill contemplates cutting the rate of the business enterprise tax, you know, until it ratchets down ultimately to the rate when it was first imposed in the 90s. So it's an interesting compromise that they worked out. And, you know, I expect we're going to hear a great deal of talk of the BET's rate cut, you know, on the campaign trail. But what will be happening for sure is the filing threshold is going to be lifted, which means that maybe several thousand businesses that now have to pay that tax won't be paying that tax.
Okay. A few big bills did fail yesterday involving so-called open enrollment in public schools and in gun policy. What happened there, Josh?
Well, the idea that public school students should be able to attend school in any district anywhere in the state that they choose, regardless of where they live, is a popular idea with plenty of the Republican majority. But the execution of this policy, you know, how it might work, how costs could be apportioned between sending and receiving districts and the state, you know, it's pretty complicated and really a bit angst-inducing for, you know, districts and policymakers. And this bill changed a bunch along the way. And what was on the table at the end was a plan that would require districts to allow open enrollment but impose a 10% cap on it. Governor Ayotte announced last week she didn't think the proposal was ready, and the bill ended up getting tabled.
Yeah, I think she said something like, it's not ready for prime time. There seemed to be a similar dynamic here with the gun bill that failed yesterday, too.
Well, yes, that bill aimed to assert that the primacy, that the legislature has primacy in terms of setting gun policy, and it would have blocked gun policies of any kind being set by cities, towns, or executive branch agencies. Ayotte's opposition to the bill didn't scuttle that, although it was pretty clear she didn't really want to see this on her desk. Attorney General John Formella, he wrote a memo to lawmakers last week urging them to defeat the bill, and it also ended up getting tabled yesterday.
All right, Josh, we also got a taste of the campaign season this week, the filing period for candidates opening on Wednesday at the State House. Can you walk us through some of what you saw as some of the top candidates formally launched their campaigns Wednesday and yesterday?
Well, yesterday, both Governor Kelly Ayotte and her Democratic challenger, Cindy Warmington, filed their campaigns. They filled the hall outside the governor's office full of supporters with signs. And, you know, sort of mini rallies. From the governor, we heard kind of what you might expect. She touted things like bail reform, her work to support police and firefighter pensions. She talked about fighting to retain the, quote, New Hampshire advantage and warned we're one election away from turning into Massachusetts. And, you know, when asked about Warmington, she repeatedly called her an opioid lobbyist. Warmington did represent Purdue Pharma at the State House and OxyContin 25 years ago. From Warmington, we heard she'd fight to make New Hampshire more affordable and that voting for Ayotte would be, in her mind, a vote for data centers and ICE detention facilities. So it was kind of blunt force on both sides in the governor's race on day one.
Absolutely. Well, the sides are set up. We'll see how it goes this summer. NHPR's senior political reporter, Josh Rogers, thanks so much as always.
You're welcome, Rick.
This is the New Hampshire News Recap. We're recapping some of the week's news. NASA says the meteorite that caused that sonic boom heard around much of coastal New England last Saturday landed right in the middle of Cape Cod Bay. The space agency says this thing was about 5 feet in diameter and weighed about 5.6 metric tons. I checked, and that works out to about 12,345 pounds in the old English. Anyway, screaming into our atmosphere at 46,000 miles an hour or so, it caused that big boom. It's thought to have exploded into fragments, meaning there could be some at the bottom of the bay. Astronomer John Gianforte is the director of the UNH Observatory. John, good morning.
Good morning.
John, we've had you often on our Cosmically Curious segment, and we talk about space. And this was a big story heard around the world and, in fact, heard right around New England, too, with that sonic boom. Did you hear it at all?
I did not hear it. I was really mad that I didn't. I spent a few days last week on Nantucket Island. What would have been a great place to listen and maybe even hear this on Saturday. But I was here in Durham near campus, and I didn't hear it. You know, these things aren't that rare, but they're rare around where you live, right? They're, you know, the Earth is big, has a lot of surface area. And, you know, it's hard to believe that between 50 and 100 tons of material fall to Earth from space every day. And most of it is very, very small micrometeorites that you can't see. But occasionally, you know, you see a shooting star or a meteor. They're not really stars shooting. They're pieces of space debris, broken off pieces of comets or small pieces of asteroids that are just orbiting the sun, minding their own business. And we call those things meteoroids. And if their path crosses the Earth and it intersects the Earth as the Earth orbits the sun, and it bursts through our atmosphere, like this one did on Saturday, we call that a meteor. If it actually makes it to the ground, like this one apparently did, landed in Cape Cod Bay, we call that a meteorite.
What might have happened if this was over land, if it had broken apart and the fragments had fallen, you know, just 15 or 20 miles, you know, away onto shore?
So it would have made a huge thump, a huge impact scar, would have left a crater, probably 15, 20 feet across, depending on what kind of terrain it struck. And it would have been you would definitely have felt that for miles around. Probably wouldn't have caused too much damage because, you know, 3 feet isn't something that we typically worry about. Although if it fell on your house, it would be a really bad day.
Yeah, right? It would. John, what do we learn from meteorites when you get these fragments and we do recover them?
Well, it teaches us, it really reveals a lot about our solar system. And we have a lot to learn. Planetary scientists have a lot to learn about small orbiting bodies in the solar system.
Right. Yeah. Can you learn something from the chemistry, from the iron that's within these meteorites?
Well, sure. You can learn about the composition. This one apparently, according to NASA, this one didn't fragment into a lot of small pieces, which leads them to believe from that it was a dense, maybe a metallic iron meteorite, which iron is a common chemical element that usually we find in the cores of the terrestrial planets. So it does teach us about the composition of the early solar system. And it's even possible in some cases, Rick, to determine the source object for the piece of space debris that fell to Earth.
Well, John, we're heading into summer, and I know the Perseid meteor showers will be happening in August, but you can catch a few meteors, you know, just about on any clear night. Any advice for catching some, for seeing some?
The best time to look for meteors is after midnight, from a relatively dark location. Doesn't have to be, you know, pitch dark, but away from city lights, away from street lights, the darkest part of your backyard where you have a pretty open place of the night sky. We can see sporadic meteors on any night if we're observant and patient and if our eyes are dark adapted.
John Gianforte is an astronomer and the director of the UNH Observatory. John, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Rick. It was my pleasure.
If you missed part of today's segment, or if you want to catch up on previous weeks, you can find the New Hampshire News Recap wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Rick Ganley, and this is NHPR.